Well,
thank you. I'm very happy to be here, and thank you for the invitation. Unlike Graham, it's not my second home yet. But funnily enough, I don't know, you might have seen this, Graham, in The Guardian on Saturday, The Guardian newspaper, this very nice colour supplement about exploring Fjord Norway with a very nice sunny picture of Bergen in it. And I thought, well... I thought that sounds like a really nice place to visit, so thanks very much. It's not quite as sunny as that, but our tourist board does the same thing, don't worry. So I'm very pleased to be here, and thank you for the invitation. I really enjoyed Graham's presentation and share a lot of his conclusions, both optimistic and some of the more pessimistic ones. Probably I'm a bit more optimistic than him. Three of the themes I think that you raised that will come up slightly in different form in mine, in my paper, will be this negotiation of relationships between professionalism and amateurism, if you want to use that term, in this, you know, digitized, globalized public sphere that is emerging. And the validity that you mentioned, although you didn't go into in great depth, but the validity and indeed necessity of entertainment and, if you like, you know, what you call the imaginative walk in the public sphere, and I very much think that is relevant to the question of public participation in democracy. And also a theme that you mentioned, the challenges of negotiating mass democracy since the advent of universal suffragism. I mean, I would say that, phrase that slightly differently and say the challenges of negotiating mass participation in democracy is one of the issues that does occur in what I want to say. So, that, you know, I think there is some overlap, although I think that my focus and tone is very different. The theme of this session is participation, and I will be addressing that in the context of a particular event which, you know, just happens to be a coincidental. Next Tuesday is May the 1st, and, of course, that is the 10th anniversary of the election of New Labour and Tony Blair to government in the UK. And, of course, Blair has announced that he will soon be resigning, and he'll be replaced in, there's Tony there, he'll be replaced, we think, in all likelihood, by Gordon Brown, who's a countryman of mine. And he will bring his own communicative style and policy agenda to the British government. And I think it's generally recognised that we're going to be moving into a new era of political communication in the UK. And I think that makes it a good time, if hopefully this will fit into the theme of the, today's present, of the symposium as a whole, kind of assess Blair's contribution to mediated political culture in the UK, and in particular the use he's made as Labour leader and Prime Minister of public service broadcasting, participatory formats. He has made it part of his political style since his election as leader in 1994 in the UK to encourage and facilitate unprecedented public access to and participation in political debate using public service broadcasting participatory formats such as the studio debate show and various others. So that's one sort of strand of what I'll be talking about. The second strand, though, is, of course, that over that same period, the broadcasters, the public service broadcasters in the UK and in many other countries have also been developing in quite an energetic and proactive way, participatory strands, you know, how to engage people in the political debate using television and radio formats. And that process does predate the emergence of the internet, of course, if you go back to the mid-90s, at least the emergence of the internet as a mass medium, as it now is. And latterly, of course, broadcasters have begun to try and integrate the potential of the internet and of the digitised, the participatory interactive potential of the digitised media which the net has generated into their programming and broadcasting infrastructure. So I will discuss the internet in the context of both Blair's approach to political communication, which I think is a uniquely participatory style, and also in the way that the public service broadcasters have sought to enhance participation within the public service political media as a whole. So that's the sort of three-pronged approach I want to take And since this is an intimate occasion, according to Jostein, I've kind of made it quite an informal presentation. My slides are available if anybody wants to take them away at some stage. Let me just make a sort of general theoretical point by suggesting, or begin by doing that, by suggesting that democracy is public participation by definition, in the sense that democracy, as I understand it, means simply that people constituted as citizens participate in voting for parties or presidents, prime ministers or councillors. And to facilitate that participation and inform the choices that citizens make, the media have always been central, so that's not new. From the very earliest times, participation has played a role in the democratic process. From the moment when we had citizens with voting rights, we had publics with opinions that mattered to those who sought election. And from then, also, we had a public sphere, as Graham discussed also, in which news about, analysis of, and commentary on political events circulated. The educated, wealthy male citizens of early bourgeois democracy participated in the embryonic public sphere by reading and writing and debating amongst themselves in the coffee house cultures. You know, that's the Habermasian sort of history. The expansion of suffragism to all of the people, more or less, in most of the advanced democracies by the early to mid-20th century was accompanied by the expansion of electronic media and the emergence of new forms of public participation, but essentially the same kind, the same principles. Radio debate shows like Any Questions in the UK, Question Time on TV and similar kinds of formats. And these remain in the UK at least, and again, you know, I apologise for speaking predominantly here about the UK. These are the normatively preferred style of mediated public participation in political debate. Debate shows, ordered, rule-governed debates, chaired by an impartial chairperson, in which representative members of the public question and debate with a balanced panel of politicians on the issues of the day. In the 1990s, and in the late 1990s in particular, Britain also saw the introduction of US-style political talk shows, mainly on radio, but to a limited degree also on TV. And of course, Sky, the non-public service broadcaster, Sky, the main one, also, you know, I think led the way or contributed, I think, quite well to that process. But these were less ordered, more volatile fora, in which ordinary people called in to comment on the issues of the day, and producers acted as gatekeepers against the most offensive and unruly callers. But talk shows were intended to be provocative, entertaining, engaging in ways which the kind of normatively prevailed formats weren't always. So the contribution of this mediated participation to democracy would be summarised under three headings, I think. Citizens are required to vote to make political choices. These should be informed, reasoned choices based on objective facts, which of course should be supplied by the political journalists, tested by debate around the appropriate interpretation of those facts, in which the citizen, him or herself, participates, or at least a representative sample of the citizenry. Those who don't participate in debate directly in the studio are kind of assumed to do so at one remove as audiences or as spectators. I don't think, though, that people are constituted as passive spectators by the broadcasters in this process. I think there's an assumption that by watching debate shows or listening to debate shows, we also participate in thinking about the processes and the questions and the issues which arise. So there's that contribution to democracy. Secondly, public participation in the public sphere is also valued as a channel of critical scrutiny of political elites and a way of enhancing the accountability of government. And I think there's a lot of evidence that this is what people want in modern democracies. People, the era of deference, as it's often been said by many others, has gone. We now live in the era when people expect to have access to politicians, political elites, in order to confront them and scrutinise and interrogate them in ways which they never used to do. These are just some quotes from focus groups that we organised at Stirling a few years ago. where voters, citizens, expressed their dissatisfaction with the aloofness and detachment of the political elite. Other researchers, the BBC itself, did some interesting research in the early, a few years ago, which showed that people are bored with political broadcasting in the conventional type. They wanted greater diversity of style, more personalised, greater accessibility. And from that, the BBC, the culture minister in the UK concluded that the job of the BBC and one of its conditions for its refunding for the next 10 years is to find new ways of engaging the public in democratic debate. A study done by the Cardiff School of Journalism, Ian Hargreaves, found that the type of programme which received most favourable mention was the format which allows the ordinary viewer to interrogate a politician or someone famous. Viewers also speak warmly of television programmes which hold power to account. I just cite those as examples of the fact that the idea that public participation is about scrutinising and interrogating power is actually one that resonates with what people want. And the third contribution that participation makes, mediated participation makes to democracy in theoretical terms, I would say, is that it legitimises the idea of democracy as something in which people do indeed participate. The mediated participation is a symbol or an index of the health of a democratic system in general. It proves that this is what democracy is, participation. Politicians have, I suppose, always participated in these programmes to some extent, participatory formats, and even senior ones, but very rarely in the past. Margaret Thatcher, John Major, former Prime Ministers, did occasionally appear on talk shows and answer questions, but usually it was done in a way that was fairly predictable from their point of view, fairly controlled, fairly risk-free. And this is, I think, where Tony Blair made his contribution or made a change. This article appeared in The Guardian a couple of weeks ago, written by former Cabinet Minister Charles Clark, talking about Tony Blair's 10 years in office. And he said, "What I remember most in 1994 was Tony's assertion that the central factor in determining the outcome of the leadership election, i.e. the Labour election of 97, would be the attitude of the media. The media had to be the target of his campaign. This core belief in the importance of media opinion and the success of this approach in winning the 1997 election became a dominating factor in the way in which a large part of government has operated over the last 10 years. And that core belief, and I think Charles Clark is right in saying that, does explain a lot about New Labour's style in office and Tony Blair's approach to government. And I think it explains why Blair, more than any other Prime Minister in British history, has used public participation media as a tool of political communication. He began that process in 1994 with the actual election itself, what was an unprecedented exercise in British politics. The three candidates for the leadership of the Labour Party election stood or participated in a debate, a panorama debate on the BBC, in which they pitched the platforms. And then there was a studio debate and there was questioning from various journalists and audience members. Nowadays, fairly unremarkable, but then quite unprecedented. And the success of that and the fact, of course, that he won that debate and he won the subsequent elections, I think, confirmed the importance in Blair's mind of this media strategy, not just being in the media, but being seen to be in some level participating, encouraging debate, facilitating debate. And developing that in government, I think, was an important aspect of Blair's communication style. Of course, everybody thinks of Blair and spin and public relations as being one aspect of New Labour. The other aspect, I would argue, is this engagement with public participation media. That came at a time, and this is just a preface to the actual period of Labour in office. The Commercial Public Service broadcast in 1997, ITV, ran a very interesting participatory experiment called the Monarchy Debate, in which a representative sample of the British people were gathered together on primetime ITV. 8 million people watched the programme to debate whether or not the British monarchy should be abolished, whether Prince Charles should be the next king. And of course, this was the time of the Diana scandals. It was before her death, but you know, there was a lot of tabloid stuff about Diana and all that. So it was a very controversial and contentious event at the time. And it very much coincides with the emergence of New Labour into government. In fact, the debate was broadcast only 2 months before the election in 1997. And that sort of, the success of that programme, and it was successful in ratings terms as well as in generating a lot of debate about the value or otherwise of public participation, inspired Blair to enter into his own kind of participatory experiments. A programme like Ask the Prime Minister, and I'll show you a clip from that in a second. The editor of that programme said, shouldn't there be a place on TV for the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom to stand up in front of an audience which duplicates the population at large and answer in a democratic form a sequence of questions about fundamental issues facing the country? This was ITV, again, the commercial public service broadcaster. And Blair obviously thought yes, and he was the one who kind of inspired this approach. At election times, in campaigning, in subsequent campaigns, the programme was renamed Ask Tony Blair, because he was, you know, technically speaking, not the Prime Minister at that point, but a campaign candidate. And the other party leaders participated in those programmes. I just want to show you one clip from that. This is the one that accompanied the 2001 election campaign, in which Tony Blair has been asked to defend what was a controversial aspect of his policy then, on health service reforms.
From the public purse.
Well, of course, that's already happening in the sense that over this winter, one of the reasons why we were able to alleviate some of the winter pressures and actually the health service had a better winter than many people feared was because we are prepared to use the private sector. And in addition, I think there's no reason why, I mean, the whole of the hospital building program at the moment is being built in partnership with the private sector. And as a result of that, the hospitals are being built on budget and on time. We explained today why we have no bar, for example, to the management of the new surgical units doing non-emergency operations being managed by the private sector as well. The key thing for me is not how the service is delivered, but that it is delivered in accordance with the National Health Service principle that care is free at the point of need for people.
Let me bring in anyone who wants to come in on the NHS. Few, lots of people. Third in the front row here, wearing the black suit.
Well, yeah. Susan Deakin, the Minister for Health in Scotland, gave assurances that all cardiac surgery would be carried out in less than 36 weeks. My son had a massive heart attack, waited 42 weeks and only had his surgery because of a cancellation. Your rhetoric has not met reality at all. When you came into government, you guaranteed you would cut waiting lists. This has not been done.
Well, actually, the waiting list...
I mean, I don't have time to show you an awful lot of that programme, but and the details of the criticism don't matter. The point is the tone, very aggressive, very critical, and quite legitimate criticism of the Prime Minister being broadcast live on air at election time. And that, I think, is typical of what Blair, you know, if you like, set himself up for in the context of this idea that public participation is important and is a good way for politicians to try and communicate effectively. He did it also on specific issues like education, tuition fees. He would appear on Newsnight and submit himself to quite aggressive questioning, as well as, you know, the journalists' questioning. And then on Iraq, I'll show you just one more clip from a Newsnight special which Blair participated in on Iraq. Again, a studio audience, very sceptical about the Iraqi policy. This is before the invasion. Very critical, referring to Blair as Bush's poodle, and that kind of language being used on air, live. And, you know, and Blair appearing to be quite comfortable and ready to submit to that approach. I'll just play a couple of minutes of this.
Military build-up, are they not merely following the example that has been set them by the threats that you and George Bush have made?
No, because, as you know, North Korea has withdrawn from the Non-Proliferation Treaty. That's extremely serious. We are trying to work with other allies now to make sure they come back into... That's one of the reasons why this is an issue we've been discussing. I have a conversation with about This was President Putin a few days ago. This is a serious issue.
Yes.
Right. Well, we're going to have to deal with each of these countries that is doing this.
Okay, Ian Davis. Yes, Mr. Prime Minister. I mean, the question's nearly almost been asked. Almost been asked already.
That's a compliment for you then.
Turner, let's see what it is first.
Yeah. Since September the 11th, obviously the United States has sort of been aggressive towards Afghanistan and now Iraq. Where's it going to stop? Who's going to be next?
Well, you know, where does it stop? It stops when we've dealt with these two twin issues, which is, as I say,
it would be nice to watch the rest of it. It's quite entertaining. But I just wanted to give you an impression of the style that I'm referring to here, and you may be familiar with it. But so the question, what is the contribution of this kind of public participation to the democratic process? And I suppose I throw this out for debate. Public participation in debate, yes. What Blair has done in the 10 years in office is to facilitate a higher degree of public participation in this kind of debate with political elites than had been possible before. And often the results of that were very raucous. You know, the sound of the crowd, to use that phrase, can be very raucous when it's unleashed. Critical scrutiny and accountability, yes, at least in appearance. Whether or not it changes policy is a different matter. And has it contributed to the legitimation of the democratic process in the UK? Yes and no, I think. And again, this is somewhat of a personal interpretation here, or evaluation. Blair, despite this kind of fairly, I would say, honest approach to the public through the media, has developed a reputation for smoothness and media slickness, which has become a negative for him. And Brown, paradoxically, Gordon Brown's more sort of taciturn image as a dour Scot. I don't know if you know what that means, but it basically means miserable and puritanical. With poor communication skills, is seen by some as a kind of welcome breath of fresh air. You know, we're fed up now with good communication. What we want is good old-fashioned, you know, serious politics. Does it work? Did it work for Blair? Well, he won an unprecedented 3 elections and a decade in power, which is now coming to an end. Yeah, as I've said, he's come to be seen as a manipulator. And more importantly, perhaps, mediated access of the type that Blair has kind of promoted hasn't arrested or reversed the decline of voting participation in the UK, especially not amongst the young, which is, I think, one of the things that Blair has tried to do, is to arrest or reverse the declining rates of democratic participation. In the 10 years that Blair has been in power, voter participation rates have actually gone down, and reaching, in fact, an all-time low at 2001, although they were slightly higher in 2005. Notwithstanding that, I think Blair's main achievement in the sphere of political communication has been to make a certain level of mediated access to politicians, facilitated through programming formats, mainly found in public service broadcasting, an expectation of the modern citizen. No future leader will be able to ignore or stand aloof from the public in the way that was routine in the past. So in that respect, I think there is an achievement. It has not stopped Blair becoming regarded as untrustworthy, and I think that does prove the importance of the fact that no matter how good a communicator politician is, if there's a gap between public perception of policy and the presentation of that policy, there is a problem of trust and a problem of legitimacy which no communication can actually overcome. And I suppose that's quite an encouraging sign from the point of view of democracy. How much time have I got? I started a wee bit late, so I've got a few more minutes. I wanted to talk now about the broadcasters, because that's the second strand of what's been going on in the last 10 years. While Blair was doing this, engaging with public participation through these kind of formats, the broadcasters themselves were developing and evolving their forms. And, you know, they were quite enthusiastic about what Blair did. You know, the ITV were very keen to have these kind of programmes at prime time, precisely for commercial reasons. ITV's big problem as a commercial broadcaster is, how do you get people to watch political television? Well, you do it by you get the Prime Minister and you subject him to quite a raw and tough live interrogation. That will get people in. So ITV and other companies have been quite enthusiastic about developing this, as has the BBC. And they've also developed an interest in reality TV formats. Espen might want to say something more about this when he presents shortly. But one of the things that struck the broadcasters in recent years with the success of Big Brother and so on is that if there is a problem of participation, of legitimacy of democracy, then one of the ways to try and reverse that is to encourage citizens to participate in ways that are analogous to the things they do on reality TV. More people participated in Big Brother 2006 than voted in the European elections in the UK, which is an interesting statistic. So what should they do? Well, let's have a reality TV political show. And they come up with, ITV came up with something called Vote For Me. Described on their website, that's what Vote For Me was about, giving real people with real issues a voice. But more than that, Vote For Me gave you, the people, the chance to choose a representative, a person who could honestly claim to be the people's choice. And basically that was five candidates standing for a real election, the 2005 election. The winner actually was given the money to go and stand in a real seat in the 2005 general election. The experiment didn't succeed, however, although I think it was a noble one, and again, it was a commercial TV development. It just didn't get the ratings. It was stuck in a late-night slot by the commissioners, and it kind of failed in that for that reason. It also, I think, demonstrated that it's not so easy just to draft in participatory strategies from entertainment, although I think the goal of harnessing the enthusiasm that people have for reality TV is quite legitimate if it can be made to work for democracy. It's not easy to do that. You know, people are actually more sophisticated. The audience is more sophisticated and will not just accept a kind of big brotherisation of politics. They want a bit more than that. But what the broadcasters, I think, hope to learn from reality TV, and you know, it remains to be seen whether they can achieve it, the value of participation, interaction, the exercise of choice by audiences sitting at home, you know, which of course they do in reality TV now routinely, the feeling of empowerment that they have some role in the outcome of political processes, and the enthusiasm generated by entertainment media, the enthusiasm which leads to engagement in the democratic process. I'm sort of skating through this very quickly now, but the final strand was just about the use of digitalisation itself, and I said at the beginning my talk hasn't really been about the internet in any depth, but it's clear now that the public service broadcasters, as Graham was saying, have woken up to the changes that the digital era is bringing to the audience, the nature of the audience, the way that they conceive their audience, and the way that they deliver programmes to their audience. And these are just some quotes from various commercial broadcasters and others. This generation has a different understanding of media and technology. It's grown up with an in-depth understanding of genre derived from television history. And now it has distribution. This is the world of digital television, digital networks, digital everything. Power in this environment is distributed equally in all parts of the system, acting in all directions simultaneously, which is a kind of optimistic utopian view, and no doubt people will want to challenge that, but this is the way the broadcasters are presenting themselves now, and I think they're trying to embrace digitalisation at least. And the BBC itself and Creative Futures, their key document for the future, described the modern audience now, the audience they see as their audience, as being interactive. The audience who don't just want to sit there, but to take part and debate and create and communicate and share. So what we now have with the public service broadcasters is the old public participation media, I say old, like studio debate shows, radio debate shows, now added to by emails, blogs, text messaging, and all the other devices and techniques for participation and interactivity that are coming into being. Will it make a difference, and I want to end with this point, will it make a difference to democracy? Will it improve or enhance democracy if, indeed, public service broadcasting enhances or embraces this participatory potential successfully? Will it matter? You know, will we be any better off? And I think that's a question that all of us are sort of asking, including the broadcasters. The answer, I think, is it's too early to say, which is a sort of academic cop-out, I know, but there you go. It's too early to say. You know, as Graham said, you know, even Rupert Murdoch only last year bought MySpace, and that was like him finally admitting that this was a reality. So we are in very early, you know, we're in very uncharted territory in relation to broadcasting and this and digitisation. But how would we know anyway if there was going to be success? How would we know if democracy was improved or not by this technology? Not simply, I would argue, by increased levels of voting, in the sense that you can be an informed citizen and a participatory citizen and not choose, or choose not to vote. Voting is not the only means of democratic participation, particularly in the modern era, where so many issues are single campaign issues, single issue campaigns, globalisation and so on, that are not, strictly speaking, party-based issues. And Helen Borden of the BBC quoted in a nice book that just came out recently, The Future of Journalism in Advanced Democracies, says, you know, you might be a fully informed citizen and decide not to vote, but spend a great deal of time working for a charity or working on a single issue campaign. There are many ways of being a citizen. So in a sense, what I'm saying is we won't expect necessarily to see the crisis of democratic participation, which is measured in terms of declining rates of voting participation, reversed by this technology. Just because people use blogs and emails doesn't mean to say they're all going to start voting. But that doesn't mean to say that they're still not having an impact on the quality of the democratic process. Will it lead to better government? You know, Tony Blair submitting himself to criticism. The blogs and the emails constantly feeding back to government and parties. Difficult, again, to measure that, because all governments are criticised all the time from different perspectives. Will we ever know what we mean by good government and better government, and how can we actually measure that it's been achieved? And the final point I want to make is that there is an interesting strand of argument, this is maybe one that we might discuss later, that more levels of participation in the media, through the media, actually damages democracy. The more participation we have beyond a certain point begins to make government unstable, unvulnerable and volatile to rumour, gossip, and lies and so on of the type that are spread on the internet. There was an interesting article in The Guardian a couple of weeks ago by US commentator Oliver Kam, who's himself a blogger, who wrote basically, the blogosphere, as he put it, is a democratic medium, allowing anyone to participate in political debate without an intermediary, at little or no cost. But it is a direct and not deliberative form of democracy. You need no competence to join in. Blogs are providers not of news but of comment. In its paucity of coverage and predictability of conclusions, the blogosphere provides a parody of democratic deliberation. Blogs are parasitic on existing news media. And Cam, in that sense, is saying don't be utopian about the potential of these new media to enhance democracy, because in fact they lead to the opposite of deliberative democracy, which is a kind of noisy, raucous, undisciplined noise in the public sphere. I'm not actually as pessimistic as that, because I think you could make those points about the traditional media, and we've been doing that in academia for decades, but I think that there is a genuine argument here that participation in itself will not enhance the quality of the public sphere. What it will do is amplify both the positive and the negative features of mediated democracy. Expanded participation in the public sphere, by definition or a priori, extends and deepens democratic mechanisms. But it also makes gatekeeping much harder to implement. And again, Espen and his project at Oslo might want to say something about this, but gatekeeping becomes harder to implement and makes the sound of the crowd that much louder. It breaks down the boundary between professional journalists and amateur pundits, which Graham mentioned at the start of his talk. The gap between the professional and the pundit, the amateur pundit on the blogosphere, has become very blurred and is creating all kinds of new ethical problems, as we saw in the Virginia Tech shootings last week. What is the relationship between the professional journalist, the professional broadcaster in the future, and these thousands, if not millions, of bloggers and people who are feeding information into the system without any professional training? It's an interesting question. So, you know, I'm personally in favour of enhancing extended participation, and, you know, and I would elaborate on that if you want. But I do think it raises interesting questions both for politicians and for broadcasters, who I think are only now beginning to challenge or beginning to face the challenge that this new digital environment poses to their established dominance of the public sphere. I'll leave it there, I think, because I've run slightly over. Okay.